well held by the senators themselves. So I think it depends a lot on the panel.
Nina Totenberg, the first panel we heard from today, the three representatives of the American Bar Association who had conducted the a review of John Roberts' qualifications, first as Associate Justice, then later as Chief Justice, this seemed rather pro forma. However, hypothetically, had they come out and said, we think he's qualified, not necessarily highly qualified, there would presumably have been a lot of questions about, well, why not highly qualified?
There would have been a lot of questions, because qualified is the lowest rating that you can get, and it would definitely have been a problem. Although it's very interesting, you know, when Justice O'Connor was nominated and when she was nominated, she was from an intermediate level appeals court in Arizona. And while everybody recognized her as an extremely able, bright judge, as she conceded in an interview that she did with me last year, she was not on anybody's list of the best qualified people in the country. And as she said, she was an affirmative act because there were very few conservative women judges at that point. On the other hand, when Clarence Thomas was nominated, the president, President Bush, nominated him, and he said he was the best qualified person. And as I recall, the only person who was willing to sort of step forward and say, no, he's not, was the former Solicitor General from the Nixon administration and Dean of the Harvard Law School, Irwin Griswold, who was pretty well up in years and cantankerous enough to just insist on coming before the committee and saying he's really not qualified for this job. But he was the only person willing to do that. So it's a very ticklish thing. I did want to say one thing, Neil, about some of these witnesses. One of the most interesting witnesses you should all listen to is a woman by the name of Maureen Mahoney, who served in the Bush administration, the first Bush one administration, as a deputy solicitor general, and has argued a lot of cases in the Supreme Court.
So would have been a colleague of John Roberts.
She was a colleague of John Roberts, and she's going to testify to that. It's very interesting because she is a conservative woman who's represented the business community, has a track record as defending conservative positions for a conservative president, and she's in her early 50s, and yet she's not ever mentioned as a possible Supreme Court nominee. And if I were George Bush, she'd sure be on my list because she'd have an instant recognition among the business roundtable. The reason I think that she's not is that she argued and won the affirmative action case for the University of Michigan in the Supreme Court. And the University of Michigan was a paying client. They came to her. She argued it just as John Roberts says he's argued lots of cases, and she won. And yet conservatives very loudly will tell you that's a disqualifying factor. Of course, in the Roberts nomination process, they say who your client is should not be a disqualifying factor. But I think it's gotten her crossed off the list, and it's going to be interesting to see if she ever climbs back on it.
Tom Goldstein, I wanted to ask you sort of about the partisan climate that has, which really hasn't attended this particular set of hearings. Clearly, Democrats more skeptical of Judge Roberts than Republicans. Clearly, they were much more probing their questions. Clearly, Republicans were defending Judge Roberts. But this was not the kind of a partisan process that every once in a while the Congress lives down to expectations on that front.
Well, it really is extraordinary. You only have to think back a few months to remember that the Senate really was on the verge of imploding over the question of judges, that the question of the Democrats filibustering President Bush's some small group of President Bush's nominees in response to what they perceived as extremist candidates and the past treatment of Clinton nominees. And here, when everyone thought that was all a prelude to the president's first nomination to the Supreme Court, all of that sense has evaporated entirely with respect to this nominee. I don't know if it's simply John Roberts' ability to persuade and the fact that Democrats are truly convinced that he is a good candidate, that he is someone that is reasonable and within the mainstream. I don't know if part of it is that Democrats are positioning themselves out of a concern that the president's next nominee will be more ideologically conservative. But whatever the cause, this process is moving forward extremely smoothly. And I think with every passing hour, you have the sense that John Roberts is going to pick up more and more votes. Now, there are going to be liberal members of the Senate who John Roberts simply could not have persuaded, absent an extraordinary conversion that would have caused him to lose Republican votes. And we have, in fact, the first hints of some Republican dissatisfaction on the question of abortion that has started to emerge.
Yeah, there's a roll call story today quoting Senator Sam Brownback, a member of this committee who you've heard talk very passionately about the question of abortion and innocent life compromised by abortions. And he said that while he's voting for Roberts, he would like the next nominee to be more have a more established record of a commitment to an anti-abortion position, that Roberts really is a little wishy-washy for him on the subject.
Roll Call, of course, one of the newspapers which covers Capitol Hill exclusively.
That's right. And I think that that's probably a battle that's going on within the administration right now. Of course, if you had such a nominee, we would be into Chapter 2 here. And we're now in Chapter 1, which is a relatively civilized agreement and disagreement among the senators. But if the president were to nominate somebody yet more with a more clear-cut record on a number of subjects, I think you would see the kind of battle royal and possibly a filibuster, fight over it, and an attempt to get some moderate Republican votes and see if they could even defeat the nominee. It would be an entirely different situation. So while this has been a relatively civilized hearing, I'm holding my breath. And I know that Chairman Spector is, too. I asked him at one point whether he thought the Roberts nomination was simply the prelude to the next. At that point, we thought there was going to be an opening for Chief Justice.
Mm-hmm.
But it was going to be the next nomination. And he said he was very worried about that.
The Senate Judiciary Committee is on a break to go vote on the Senate floor. We're in the point of the hearings where we're listening to outside witnesses. Earlier today, Judge John Roberts wrapped up his testimony before the Senate Judiciary Committee. Questions almost entirely today from Democratic members are the only people who asked for a third round in terms of questions for Judge Roberts. There was the, as it turned out, pro forma retirement to ask him questions in private about whatever may have emerged, if anything, from the FBI background investigation. That was quite brief, and then we began testimony from the outside witnesses, which is going to be continuing throughout the day. Getting back to the question, Tom Goldstein, about the next nomination, part of the civility or relative civility of this proceeding, a lot of people see that John Roberts replacing William Rehnquist is pretty much of a wash, one conservative replacing another.
I think that's an excellent point. It illustrates that the only issue isn't just how John Roberts views the law, but what he will do to the Supreme Court of the United States. And everyone started out with the sense that John Roberts really would be in the mold of his mentor and the justice for whom he clerked, William Rehnquist. And Nina explored with former Solicitor General Charles Freed whether even that might be slightly inaccurate, whether John Roberts might still have a slightly different take on the law. But in general, if you do sort of caricature the justices and you take Justice Scalia and Justice Thomas on the further on the ideological right, you do have the sense that John Roberts will be more like William Rehnquist, which means that this is a wash. Then you replace Sandra Day O'Connor, who has provided the fifth vote, sometimes on the liberal side, sometimes on the conservative side. But it has been in so many important cases on, for example, abortion and affirmative action, that her vote mattered so much. And there, Democrats really will come to the next set of hearings with the sense that their vote matters not only because, as they said here, the person will be there for 40 more years, but because the new nominee's vote for the second position, the replacement of O'Connor, could really change the direction of the law fundamentally.
And you see that the Democrats almost are setting that up in these hearings. two of the witnesses who are going to be testifying on this nomination were plaintiffs in 5-4 cases in which Justice O'Connor was the deciding vote. One was Coach Roderick Jackson, who was a coach of a girls' basketball team in Alabama, in Birmingham, complained to the school board that his teams were not getting equal treatment to the boys, that they had to practice in the old rickety gym, that they didn't get their fair share of the money, that they didn't get bus rides to games, et cetera, et cetera. And he, when he wouldn't let it, as he put it, he was told to play ball, and when he didn't play ball, he got fired from his coaching job. And he sued, representing himself all the way up until he got to the Supreme Court, when I think it was the National Women's Law Center represented him. The school board claimed that he didn't have any right to sue, that he hadn't been discriminated against because he wasn't one of the girls. His argument was, well, you don't expect children to defend themselves. I'm the person right. who can do that. And I'm the one who suffered and lost my job. And the Supreme Court agreed with him 5-4 with Justice O'Connor, the deciding vote. And then we talked earlier about Beverly Jones, who is a court stenographer in a wheelchair and couldn't get a lot of jobs because she couldn't get into the courthouses in Tennessee. And again, her case, she won 5-4 with Justice O'Connor. She was one of the plaintiffs in the case, and carried the day 5-4. And Tom Goldstein worked on that case for Beverly Jones and some of the other plaintiffs, right, Tom?
Exactly. That was a fascinating case, and I think it's really one of the cases that causes some people to be frustrated with the Supreme Court, because in these 5-4 decisions, considering how federal law coexists with the right of the states, the Supreme Court is truly blown hot and cold, and it's sometimes hard to say why the Supreme Court said that one law was okay and another one wasn't, or one application of the law, here the application to the courthouses was perfectly fine under the Constitution, but the application of Title I of the ADA, another provision, couldn't be used to sue the states. And if I could actually just sort of pick up on the theme of how these cases get litigated at the Supreme Court, you know, you mentioned that John Roberts is going to have a new day job soon, and the Supreme Court term is actually only a few weeks away. I'm arguing the first case on the first day. And John Roberts, who, as we've heard throughout these proceedings, is so meticulous in his preparations, I'm sure is getting quite anxious about getting ready for sitting down in the Chief Justice's chair in a couple of weeks and asking intelligent questions and being ready to vote. So he does face a dilemma of at what point he starts to make the transition, even because there are formal barriers. He can't really so much be in contact, formal contact with the court. He can't start acting like a justice because he hasn't been confirmed. So, and he also has the job of answering the set of written questions that were mentioned today. Mm-hmm. So it's going to be a tough job to make that transition.
So, Tom, this must be a really fascinating case on the first day.
This case is really one of the traditional cases the Supreme Court takes, which is to say it's actually relatively dull.
So you're telling us it's a dog.
It is a
not
dog.
Not to you and your client,
no,
but to...
our clients are very interested in the case, but it really illustrates what it is that the Supreme Court does day in, day out. It's not an abortion case, an affirmative action case, or a gay rights case. It is the question whether in a chicken processing plant... whether the workers, when they get there, everybody agrees when they get to their job, they should be paid for the time they put on and take off the special clothing that protects them in the on the factory floor. But the question is, while they're waiting for that equipment and moving between equipment stations, do they get paid for that time? And this is the classic thing that concerns the Supreme Court. It actually affects a lot of workers. It's not remotely sexy, but it's important, and different courts had come up with different answers to the question of whether the walking and waiting time associated with donning and doffing protective clothing is compensable under the Portal to Portal Amendment to the Fair Labor Standards Act. Now, that sentence makes sense to almost nobody. But it is the kind of thing that the Supreme Court justices have to confront. They have 80 or so cases like this every year. And you can understand just from the statement of it that there's no necessarily obvious answer to it. It requires a lot of study of precedent that we've been talking about and parties' briefs. There are probably 15 briefs in the case.
Well, Tom, with respect, I'm sure you think there's an obvious answer to it. Your clients.
Well, I'm trying to be fair about it. I think that, you know, John Roberts, when he had my job, which is to represent people before the Supreme Court, he thought, or at least was willing to articulate the position that his clients were obviously right. Surely John Roberts will agree with us.
Which side are you on, Tom?
We're on the good side. And
what's the good side?
The good side in this case is the side of the workers. We say that, you know, the employer makes you show up at work and makes you wait for this stuff and makes you go between the stations. And if you're having to do that as your job, then you got to get paid for it.
Tom, save the argument for the court.
Yeah.
But let me ask you a question. When you go in and say on a more one of these weightier issues, say the courthouse steps kind of case. Do you go in there as an advocate and start saying, all right, my job is to count to five? And you look at the court and you say, we've got him for sure, don't have her. Is that the calculation you go through at some point?
It depends on the case. And let me first answer it from John Roberts' perspective, because he really was the best Supreme Court advocate when he did this. And John Roberts said the answer to that question was basically no. That he said you can't overanalyze this. All you can hope to do is be as ready as humanly possible to answer everybody's questions clearly and concisely. Now, that I think is an overstatement. There are times when you go into a case and the justices have talked about the issue before and they've made very clear that they are not with you. Now, that doesn't mean you can ignore their questions. In answering their questions, you have to persuade other people. But John Roberts, who is the very best at this, said, no, you are answering questions of the Supreme Court of the United States. You want the votes of the members of the Supreme Court of the United States. Don't try and get too tricky about this justice or that.
Nina?
You know, I'll tell you a great story. When Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg was an advocate who argued gender discrimination cases exclusively in the Supreme Court. That was the area she pioneered, and she argued, I don't remember how many, but a lot of cases. And there is a famous story about her that as she concluded her argument one day and walked out of the courtroom, one of her colleagues said to her, why didn't you answer Justice Stevens' question? And she said, because if I'd answered Justice Stevens' question, I would have lost Justice Powell's vote. So she just was dodging and weaving. And Neil, I want to say another thing on a completely different subject. We're sitting here up in a booth overlooking the hearing room, and we're sort of watching people milling around. And you're seeing an illustration of the interesting coalitions in political life in Washington. I just watched former Attorney General and Republican Pennsylvania Governor Dick Thornburgh posing for pictures with Beverly Jones, who was the plaintiff in the Tennessee Americans with Disabilities Act case, and other people from the disabilities rights community. And he's been extremely active in that whole area. I think he has a disabled child, and he has been vigilant about protecting the rights of the disabled. And it's an area in which he is not in any sense a traditional conservative. He has fought for every piece of turf for the disabled that he can possibly get. And at the same time, you see, he's here, you know, testifying for Judge Roberts, and very much normally a part of the conservative community in Washington. But down there, he was posing with a bunch of people who I think would who are part of the liberal community testifying today.
We're waiting for the Senate Judiciary Committee to return. The Senate is voting at the moment, and they want to resume hearing from these outside witnesses who have gathered to testify for or against the nomination of John Roberts to be Chief Justice of the United States. Given what Nina was talking about, I should probably explain that this hearing room in the Hart Senate Office Building It's got about a 30-foot ceiling, and around the top layer, the equivalent to where skyboxes might be in a baseball stadium, that's where these booths, these broadcast booths, have been set up, and that's we're located in one of them that is sort of wraps around the upper floor. Below us is another bank of openings in the wall where photographers and TV cameras can gather, and then there's the floor itself. You've probably seen pictures of the committee table, a U-shaped table in the front of the room, and senators sit around that. It's on a raised platform, and then below that is the pit where the photographers also gather, the witness table, then behind that many card tables set aside for members of what we like to refer to as the pencil press. Those are the people who don't need booths to broadcast from, newspapers, wire services, that sort of thing, who have gathered to cover these hearings. And beyond that, chairs that face the front of the room, members of the public, a lot of law students come here to observe these proceedings, Tom Goldstein, pick up what they can to figure out a little bit about their future careers.
Well, I think it's interesting. I had the opportunity to do this as Nina's intern for both the Ginsburg and Breyer hearings as I finished up law school. And it's really a historic moment. We get sort of focused on the politics of it. We get focused on the particular nominee. But we were last here more than 11 years ago, and it shows how extraordinarily important the process is when people talk about John Roberts being on the Supreme Court and being the Chief Justice for 40 years. It is not hyperbole. That is, God willing, with his health, exactly what's going to happen. And there is a timelessness to this. It's also extraordinary because of the way it represents the one time when all three branches of government come together. We've got the president who picks the nominee, the Senate who decides whether or not they're going to consent to the nominee, and then the person goes on the judiciary. And we sometimes think of the federal government as just this amorphous mass, and sometimes we think about just the courts. But this is, you know, more than 200 years ago, the framers thought, you know, how are we going to make this whole thing work? How are we going to get reasonable judges on there? And once they're on the courts, how will we make sure that they're not unduly influenced? This is the process they came up with, and nobody's got a better one.
Tom teaches a course in Supreme Court practice. It's actually almost, it's a clinic at Stanford Law School. He goes out, I don't know, a week, a month, something like that. And I'm wondering how your students perceive of this process compared to the reality.
Well, I think the students of today, you know, you talk about people who don't have the broadest historical sense. They're just learning about the law, have a bit of a jaded sense of the process because they have come to focus on it in an era of much greater partisanship. That's true of me as well. I am a product of the sort of post-Judge Bork hearing era. Whether or not they have a sense that the process actually produces good judges and good questions and an accurate sense of the nominee, I think is probably something in flux because this is clearly the first time they've gone through it. But I would say that what they know of things comes from the Court of Appeals process. And that has been an extraordinarily divisive process. And I wouldn't say that the students of today have confidence that senators from both sides and the president are actually nominating the best people for the commitment that John Roberts has talked about so much, the commitment to the rule of law.
At least some of the senators have begun returning to the committee room. I saw Lindsey Graham of South Carolina, Ted Kennedy of Massachusetts have returned, and I think that's Mike DeWine down on the floor from Ohio. He's also back, so that suggests that they will be resuming listening to witnesses in just a few minutes, a break for a vote on the Senate floor. Nina Totenberg, obviously a lot of what has happened over the past this past week is sending signals. Judge Roberts at times saying, well, even if I can't comment directly on a case that might come before the Supreme Court, wink, wink, nod, nod, yes, I do think there's a right of privacy. Make of that what you will. We were talking about earlier about where he would slot ideologically. One thing he kept saying was, look at the record that I've established 50 opinions on the D.C. Court, that appeals court on which he serves. And he kept, at one point, seemed to be suggesting that, you know, look who I've agreed with and look who I haven't agreed with. At one point, making almost a point to say, David Sentell, a conservative jurist on the D.C. Court, disagreed with me on this case. Was he signaling I am less conservative than Judge Sentell?
Yeah, I think he was.
I agree with that.
Tom, do you remember what the Barber case was about? Because I don't.
Yes, I do. This was a case about the ability to sue WMATA, which is the transportation agency around D.C., and the question of whether Congress could, on the basis of WMATA having accepted federal funds, subject the D.C. government to a suit. And David Sentell wanted to limit Congress's powers. He said that you could only do that if the money really related to the suit that was being filed. And John Roberts said, no, the Supreme Court has written more broadly. And I do think that's a pointed example.
Chairman Specter, let's listen in.
Our next witness is Congressman John Lewis of Georgia, an architect of the historic March on Washington in August of 1963, been the representative for Georgia's 5th Congressional District since November of 1986 when he was elected, took office in January, B.A. in Religion and Philosophy from Fisk University, graduate of American Baptist Theological Seminary. Thank you for crossing the rotunda today, Congressman Lewis, and we look forward to your testimony.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, and distinguished members of the committee, I'm honored to be here today. As many of you know, this is not the first time I've come before this committee. I was here 14 years ago when the nomination of another justice to the Supreme Court moved me to speak out. I'm here today with the hope that this committee will hear my words and take heed. When I was growing up in rural Alabama, I saw those signs that said white men, colored men, white women, colored women. I used to ask my parents, my grandparents, why racism? Why racial discrimination? And they would tell me, don't get in trouble. Don't get in the way. As a participant in the civil rights movement of the 1960s, I decided to get in the way. I was beaten, arrested, and jailed more than 40 times for peaceful, nonviolent protests against legalized segregation in the South. During that time, I saw American citizens with their hair cracked open by nightsticks, lying in the streets, weeping from tear gas, trampled by horses, and attacked by police dogs, calling helplessly for medical aid. Back then, legalized discrimination was enforced by state and local officials. The federal government was our only hope, and we depended on the Supreme Court to act as a sympathetic referee in the struggle for justice and civil rights. I remember on one occasion when the court issued a decision on public transportation, an elderly black woman was overheard to say, God Almighty has spoken from Washington. In 1965, George Roberts was only 10 years old. He may be a brilliant lawyer, but I wonder whether he can really understand the depth of what it took to get the Voting Rights Act passed. The right to vote is precious, almost sacred. It is the most powerful, nonviolent tool we have in a democratic society. As many of you know, I gave a little blood on the Edmund Pettus Bridge, but some of my friend and colleague gave all they had, their very lives, for the right to vote. People stood day after day in unmovable lines to pass their so-called literacy tests. They had to interpret certain sections of the Constitution, count the number of jelly beans in a jar, or the number of bubbles in a bar of soap to register to vote. I fear that if Judge Roberts is confirmed to be the Chief Justice of the United States, the Supreme Court would no longer hear the people's cries for justice. I feel that the leadership of the court will promote politics over the protection of individual rights and liberties. If the federal courts had abandoned us in the civil rights movement in the name of judicial restraint, we might still be struggling with the burden of legal segregation in America today. George Roberts' memos reveal him to be hostile towards civil rights, affirmative action, and the Voting Rights Act. He has even said that Voting Rights Act violation, and I quote, should not be made too easy to prove.
Under the court's decision in Mobile versus Bolden, the court weakened the Voting Rights Act. Under this ruling, many political subdivisions would have been permitted to maintain a large election system, diluting minority voting strength. This may be less obvious than the violence and intimidation of the 1965, but it is no less harmful to our nation's principles of inclusive democracy. Section 2 has been successful in reducing barriers and has increased the number of minority elected officials. There is no doubt, Mr. Chairman, in my mind, that had Judge Roberts' narrow reading of the Voting Rights Act prevail, few people of color will be serving in Congress and at both the state and local level today. As our nation is still reeling from the tragedy of Hurricane Katrina, the timing of these hearings could not be more significant. What happened in New Orleans and along the Gulf Coast of Alabama, Mississippi, and Louisiana exposed the issue of race, class, and fairness yet again. We are still a nation deeply divided by race and class. All Americans, by every race or every religion or nationality, whether they are women or men, gay or straight, or people with disability, all of us need equal access to a fair and independent judiciary to ensure equal justice under the law. The stakes are higher than ever. We cannot afford to elevate an individual to such a powerful lifetime position whose record demonstrates such a strong desire to reverse the hard-won civil rights gain that so many of us sacrifice so much to achieve. We have come a great distance. We cannot afford to stand still. We cannot afford to go back. We must go forward to the creation of one America. My friends, members of the Senate, I implore you to get in the way. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much, Congressman Lewis, for those very passionate remarks. Our next witness is Commissioner Jennifer Braceras, U.S. Commission for Civil Rights, taught at the Suffolk Law School, is a visiting fellow at the Independent Women's Forum. In the year 2000, Massachusetts Lawyers Weekly rated her as one of the state's top 10 lawyers of the year. Practiced law with the Boston firm of Ropes and Gray. Thank you for joining us, Commissioner Braceras, and we look forward to your testimony.
Thank you. Chairman Spector, Senator Leahy, members of the committee, my name is Jennifer Braceras. I am a resident of Massachusetts and a member of the Massachusetts Bar and the Hispanic National Bar Association. I am, as you said, a visiting fellow with the Independent Women's Forum, and I am privileged to serve, by appointment of the President, as a commissioner on the United States Commission on Civil Rights. I am honored to be here today to support the nomination of Judge John Roberts to be Chief Justice of the United States. Although I do not know Judge Roberts personally, I am generally familiar with his background and record. His distinguished career and his testimony before this committee make clear to even the most casual observer that Judge Roberts is eminently well qualified for the post. Despite these obvious qualifications, however, opponents of Judge Roberts criticize his record on a variety of matters that loosely fall under the umbrella of civil rights. These critics allege that Judge Roberts' confirmation to be Chief Justice will somehow be harmful to women and minorities. These charges are at best misplaced and at worst deliberately misleading attacks that would have been leveled against anyone nominated by this president. There are at least five reasons why such criticisms are without merit. First, many of the specific criticisms of Judge Roberts' record involve positions he advocated as a lawyer in the administrations of Presidents Ronald Reagan and George H.W. Bush. Some of the subjects that have elicited criticism by interest groups include school busing, racial quotas, the revision of the voting rights legislation to seek equal electoral results as opposed to equal access, and the theory of comparable worth. Published reports indicate that the positions taken by Judge Roberts in this capacity as a lawyer for the Reagan and Bush administrations, are broadly consistent with the views of the American people and fully within the political mainstream. But even if they were not, the arguments expressed by Judge Roberts as a young man decades ago are arguments on behalf of the administrations for which he worked, not the views of a neutral umpire asked to rule on particular legislation. Judge Roberts' view of the judicial function does not contemplate the imposition of his own policy preferences from the bench. His commitment to judicial restraint should give Americans of all political viewpoints great comfort. Second, it is clear from the public record that Judge Roberts supports the vigorous enforcement of our nation's anti-discrimination laws. In his executive branch memos, Judge Roberts repeatedly defended the, quote, bedrock principle of treating people on the basis of merit without regard to race or sex, unquote. And he argued numerous times for the executive branch to prosecute claims of unequal treatment to the fullest extent of the law. Third, as an advocate, Judge Roberts has been on both sides of controversial civil rights questions. This broad experience should give the American people faith in Judge Roberts' ability to understand the complexity of controversial issues. Fourth, it is clear that Judge Roberts has a strong commitment to equal opportunity and to the anti-discrimination principle embodied in the 14th Amendment and codified in the Civil Rights Act of 1964. He has written, and I quote, "Before the law, we do not stand as black or white, Gentile or Jew, Hispanic or Anglo, but only as Americans entitled to equal justice. Certainly, there is nothing extreme or unusual about this view. To the contrary, it embodies the American ideal. It reflects the aspirations of the 14th Amendment, which were given life by the court in Brown versus Board of Education and by the framers of the 1964 Act. Finally, and perhaps most importantly, irresponsible rhetoric that a court led by Judge Roberts would be hostile to civil rights misinterprets the role of the court in our democracy. This rhetoric is based on several deeply flawed premises. First, such rhetoric presumes that it is the job of the court to create new rights in response to evolving circumstances. It is not. Our Constitution guarantees certain basic rights which the courts must, of course, enforce. Legislatures, both state and federal, may expand upon those rights or create new ones, provided that they act within the scope of their constitutional authority. If citizens are in any way dissatisfied with the scope or reach of current law, it is to their democratically elected representatives, not the courts, that they must turn. Second, Judge Roberts' critics erroneously presume that courts should interpret all statutory language expansively. That is also not their role. Their role is to apply statutes as written.
Commissioner Braceras, could you summarize the balance of your statement, please?
Sure.
Your full statement will be made a part of the record, as will all statements.
The Supreme Court is neither the first nor the last word on civil rights, or any other issue for that matter. Each of the three branches of government has a role to play, and Judge Roberts respects and understands these distinct roles. In conclusion, I submit that Judge Roberts' critics have it wrong. Judge Roberts' commitments to the vigorous enforcement of our nation's civil rights laws and to the bedrock principles of judicial restraint, judicial review, and equal opportunity will make him a justice of whom all Americans can be proud. And I urge you to confirm him as the next Justice of the United States, Chief Justice of the United States.
Thank you very much, Commissioner Braceras. Senator Leahy has asked for recognition before we complete the panel. Senator Leahy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A classmate of mine from law school was supposed to testify. We changed this by a week as unable. I just want to make sure the testimony of John W. Dean is put in the record at the appropriate place.
Without objection, it will be made a part of the record.
Yes, that John W. Dean, the Watergate figure, and has also taken a position on several of these issues, but not able to appear here today.
On civil rights. Before his current position, he was Washington Bureau Director of the NAACP, serves as the Rao Professor of Public Interest Law at the Clark School of Law, graduate of Howard University and the Rutgers University School of Law. I know you talked to David Rogge about a postponement of the hearing, and then events overtook us, and the postponement did take place. Thank you for
this. This is Wade Henderson
today
of the Leadership Conference on Civil Rights.
The floor is yours.
Well, good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, and thank you, Mr. Chairman, for your courtesies in giving us an additional week because of the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina. Again, my name is Wade Henderson, and I'm the Executive Director of the Leadership Conference on Civil Rights. The Leadership Conference is the nation's premier civil and human rights coalition and has coordinated the national legislative campaigns on behalf of every major civil rights law since 1957. The Leadership Conference's 190 member organizations represent persons of color, women, children, organized labor, individuals with disabilities, older Americans, major religious groups, gays and lesbians, and civil liberties and human rights groups. It's a privilege to represent the civil rights community in addressing the committee today. Based on reasons I will highlight here today, discussed at greater length in my written testimony, and after a careful review of John Roberts' available record, including his testimony before this committee, the Leadership Conference is compelled to oppose his confirmation to the position of Chief Justice of the United States. In the last several days of testimony, Judge Roberts has failed to distance himself from the anti-civil rights positions he has advocated. We have heard nothing demonstrating his commitment to ensuring that the federal government will continue to play a strong role in protecting civil and human rights of all Americans. To the contrary, all evidence indicates that Judge Roberts would use his undeniably impressive legal skills to bring us back to a country that most of us wouldn't recognize, where states' rights trump civil rights, where the federal courts or Congress can see discrimination but are powerless to remedy it. This is not the America in which most Americans want to live. As we've seen over the past 2 weeks in the wake of Hurricane Katrina, when the federal government's role is diminished, the least among us suffer most. Our nation fought a civil war over the meaning of equality in our Constitution and the role of the federal government in ensuring that equality, and then engaged in a great debate about the power of the federal government to enforce the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments. Reconstruction failed, and African Americans were returned to a position of near servitude because those who advocated for weak federal power won. It wasn't until decades later, when the court outlawed state-sponsored segregation in Brown versus the Board of Education, followed by the enactment of a series of civil rights statutes by Congress in the 1960s that are now the bedrock of our national commitment to equality of opportunity, that the federal government stepped in as a champion of equal justice under law. However, in recent years, we've seen the rise of a political movement that is an eerie parallel to the post-Reconstruction period. Today, there are those who, in the name of judicial restraint, advocate for a federal retreat in the area of civil rights. While our Constitution speaks of fundamental rights, some oppose the federal courts or Congress using the Constitution to protect individuals against violations of those rights. John Roberts has written that federal courts should not be empowered to invalidate, quote, widely accepted state practices, unquote, even if such practices prevent African Americans and others from having equal opportunity in voting. If his view had prevailed, our country's voting rights revolution would never have happened. Would Judge Roberts have approved of poll taxes or literacy tests because those were, quote, widely accepted practices? Despite the strong recommendation from a very conservative member of the Reagan administration's civil rights team, John Roberts advised against intervention in a sex discrimination case against the Kentucky prison system, contending that discriminatory treatment of men and women in the prison's vocational program was, quote, reasonable in light of tight prison budgets, unquote. Would Judge Roberts then apply the same argument to equal educational opportunities for women generally? Could states, in the name of saving money, refuse to provide equal health services to men and women? In John Roberts' view, Congress could exclude all school desegregation cases from the jurisdiction of the federal courts. This is, in effect, a pre-Brown vision that fits squarely into the objective of preventing the federal courts from fulfilling the promise of the 14th Amendment. As many commentators have made clear, John Roberts is a gifted and intelligent lawyer and advocate, but that is not the test for determining whether he is fit to lead the highest court in the land. Rather, the test is whether John Roberts has demonstrated he is committed to the fundamental principles on which our country was founded, and whether his vision of America matches the expectations of mainstream Americans. John Roberts has failed this test. Therefore, the Leadership Conference on Civil Rights has no choice but to oppose his confirmation. America can and should do better. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much, Mr. Henderson. Our next witness is Commissioner Peter Kersenow of the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights, had been labor counsel for the City of Cleveland. He's the chair of the Board of Directors of the Center for New Black Leadership, on the advisory board of the National Center for Public Policy Research, a graduate of Cornell, a law degree from Cleveland State with honors. Thank you for coming in today, Commissioner, and we look forward to your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Senator Leahy, members of the committee. I am Peter Kersenow, a member of the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights and a partner in the Cleveland, Ohio law firm of Bennett, Friedlander, Copeland, Aronoff in the labor and employment practice. I'm here in my personal capacity. The U.S. Commission on Civil Rights was established in 1957 to, among other things, act as a national clearinghouse for information related to denials of equal protection and discrimination. And in furtherance of that function, my assistant and I reviewed the opinions of Judge Roberts while in the D.C. Circuit related to civil rights, and also a Supreme Court advocacy related to civil rights, particularly with respect to prevailing civil rights norms, jurisprudential norms, with particular attention to the 1964 Civil Rights Act and the 14th Amendment. Our examination reveals that Judge Roberts' approach to civil rights is consistent with mainstream textual interpretation of the relevant constitutional and statutory authority and governing precedent. His opinions evince appreciable degrees of judicial restraint, modesty, and discipline, and in short, Judge Roberts' approach to civil rights is exemplary. It is legally sound, intellectually honest, and with a deep appreciation for the historical bases for civil rights laws. And our examination also reveals that several aspects of Judge Roberts' civil rights record have been mischaracterized, and sometimes the criticisms have been sorely misplaced. For example, conflating his counsel and advocacy on the part of clients with his own personal policy preferences. Just three brief examples. First, some have contended that during the 1982 reauthorization of the Voting Rights Act, Judge Roberts had adopted an anti-civil rights approach to the or interpretation of the act. But the record definitively shows that Judge Roberts had consistently counseled in favor of reauthorization of the entire act as is, and he expressed the administration's concern that a substantive redefinition of Section 2 could risk introducing confusion and uncertainty into what had already been considered one of the nation's most successful pieces of civil rights legislation. Judge Roberts continued to advocate on behalf of his client for vigorous enforcement of Section 2, even after adoption of the effects test. Second, some have claimed that Judge Roberts' position on affirmative action is regressive. Most of these criticisms relate to his questioning of a 1981 U.S. Commission on Civil Rights report pertaining to affirmative action. A detailed examination of that report shows that not only was Judge Roberts' criticism correct, but imperative. The Commission's report was inconsistent with the status of the law in 1981 when issued and fails to comport with the post-Adirondack Constructors versus Pena, Grutter versus Bollinger affirmative action norms of today. Judge Roberts had properly advised against unlawful racial quotas and set asides untethered to a proof of discrimination. He supported the, and we heard it earlier, quote, bedrock principle of treating people on the basis of merit without regard to race or sex, end quote. A third contention, unsupported by examination, is that Judge Roberts' arguments before the Supreme Court in civil rights matters were somehow extreme rather than mainstream. Probabilities would dictate that if Judge Roberts had somehow slipped past the Supreme Court's gatekeepers and got to make extremist arguments before the court, that the court would have dismissed virtually 100% of those arguments, or at a bare minimum, far more than 50%, which is the fate of most arguments before the court. Again, a review of the record shows that Judge Roberts' arguments with respect to civil rights were agreed to by the Supreme Court 71% of the time, hardly indicative of positions outside of prevailing civil rights norms. And these justices who agreed with him included those who might colloquially be described as conservative, such as Justice Rehnquist, who agreed with him 75% of the time, or Justices Scalia and Thomas, each of whom agreed with him 71% of the time. But they also include justices colloquially described as liberal, such as Justice Ginsburg, who agreed with him 60% of the time, Justice Souter 59% of the time, Justice Stevens 59% of the time, and even Justice Thurgood Marshall, the premier civil rights litigator probably forever, agreed with his advocacy position 67% of the time, almost as much as Justices Scalia and Thomas, and more than Justice O'Connor. Mr. Chairman, it's respectfully submitted that Judge Roberts' 25-year record with respect to matters pertaining to civil rights demonstrates an unwavering commitment to equal protection and a comprehensive understanding of our civil rights laws that would make him an outstanding addition to the Supreme Court, particularly in the capacity of Chief Justice. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much, Commissioner. Our next witness and final witness on this panel is Judge Nathaniel Jones. Had served as executive director of the Fair Employment Practices Commission, was an assistant U.S. attorney for the Northern District of Ohio, directed NAACP litigation as general counsel for 10 years, a graduate of Youngstown State University, both bachelor's and law degrees, and served on the Court of Appeals for the Sixth Circuit, and is now retired. Judge Jones, thank you for coming in today, and we look forward to your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Senator Leahy, and esteemed members of the committee. I am honored to have this opportunity to appear as a witness today to, I hope, assist you to more effectively evaluate the fitness of John G. Roberts to be confirmed as Chief Justice of the United States by providing an historical perspective. Mr. Chairman, I ask that my full statement be introduced in the record.
Without objection, Judge Jones, it will be a part of the record.
Thank you. My acceptance of your invitation to offer testimony is prompted by my conscience and is driven by a profound obligation to introduce into the record an historical perspective, and in doing so, I join with my colleague John Lewis, whose life is a personification of courage. And I wish to add to his description of the struggle for civil remedies and civil rights remedies. You are confronted here, I suggest, with a serious constitutional and moral responsibility.